Hello and welcome to the History Show on Near FM. My name is Cathal Brennan, and on today's show we're very pleased to be joined by Alex O'Faley. Alex is a graduate of Trinity College Dublin and the University of Edinburgh. In this episode we will be talking about Irish radicalism in Scotland. Alex, you're very welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
Now, first off, I'd like to ask you about a term used by James Connolly, Celtic communism. What's that term mean to you?
To me, it means slightly different to what Connolly meant. Connolly meant in the general sense that Irish people, because of their past, the Celtic past, which he believed to be communistic, or at the very least communalistic, that Irish people had a predisposition to be socialistic or radical in some way. He believed that this was across the board, and that he gave several evidences of this in terms of the land war and the 1913 strike and lockout. To me, it means something far more complicated. It's far more complicated to me in its meaning. To me, it's something which can be proven to have existed in a given time in Irish and Scottish history, in particular in the case of Scottish history within the Irish community. To me, it began in, much like Connolly's interpretation, that it was a culture of remembrance of a egalitarian past. However, we can now prove that the egalitarian past, the Celtic communism, communalistic past, did not exist. There was, or at least not in the record we have. Rather, there was in fact a very strict hierarchy within Gaelic culture, that which increased in form as feudalism was melded with the pre-existing Gaelic society, and that by the time of the dispossessions of Cromwell, Irish society was very hierarchical, and property was, if not officially private, basically private. So at least in origin, or at least in fact, people looked back, they did look back to a time when there was supposedly more egalitarianism, or more of an equality between classes, if there was such a thing as class at the time. However, in fact, we can now prove that this didn't exist. So therefore, what is, in my interpretation, Celtic communism? The history, the record seems to suggest that, in particular in the south of Ulster, along the borders of communities between the Catholic and the Protestant community, there grew up, within the Catholic community, a radicalized agrarian community that was led in the latter stages of the 1790s by the United Irishmen. The most prominent name of this grouping has been called the Defenders, which is, for most anyone who knows anything about agrarian societies, it's one of the many names people associate with, like the White Boys or the Peabody Boys were Protestant, but again, another agrarian terrorist group, if you want to call it that, as well as the Oak Boys and the later on the Ribbon Men. However, the thing that was different about the Defenders was that, as opposed to the other groups, within the Catholic community throughout Ireland, they didn't have as powerful a native ruling group. The ruling group had been, for the most part, dispossessed, and unlike the rest of Ireland, where ruling elites in, say, Kerry or in other parts of Munster remained powerful within the role of a middleman, within the south of Ulster and various other parts as well, they'd been reduced to, say, the state of a publican or a just another tenant. Now, while they were prominent families, they no longer had the power or authority to control and promote deference from the other tenants who had formerly been their tenants. So there grew up a radicalism amongst the people. Obviously, the rest of, at the time, there was quite a lot of support for the ideas, the Jacobin ideas, which were to remove Protestant influence in the population completely from Ireland and make them, you know, like slaves to the Catholics. It was kind of like a revenge mentality. This was most promulgated by the ruling elites, the former ruling elites, who are now middlemen in the other parts of Ireland, primarily because they wanted to regain their land, obviously. But within South Ulster, a particular situation emerged where the actual people, the people themselves, who had never owned land in the sense of their former rulers, started propagating these ideas because they were the only groups there at the time. This obviously created quite an odd scenario of radicalism and yet conservatism at the same time. Now, by the middle of the 1790s, about 1795, 1796, this is where the United Irishmen emerge and come into the scenario. they had obviously been trying to radicalize the population. They'd had most success with the Presbyterians, which is a different story altogether and equally interesting. And hopefully I'll touch on that somewhat in the book. But they were looking for allies, and they saw a ready and large force of allies in the Defenders movement, which had grown quite significantly, probably around 60,000 at that point, if not more. And there was an open door. There was no ruling group controlling the Defenders. There was no one telling them to go this way or that, as they're going, telling them what direction to go. So they were quite easily made contact with some of the most noted members of the Defender movement, who, as it happened, actually probably were former, their ancestors would have been Gaelic chiefs, such as the Teelings and the McGuinnesses. The contacts were made, and it was quite an easy process of radicalization to convert them to ideas from Jacobite ideas to Jacobin ideas, the ideas of a republic and the Enlightenment. And within a very short amount of time, it would seem that most of the Defender movement was signed up to the United Irish movement. And what is then shown in the subsequent 1798 is that they were quite heavily involved in South Ulster in the battles of Armagh and other Ballinahinch, to name a few. And within the United Irish movement, there was themselves theorists such as Arthur O'Connor, who had ideas of land nationalisation or land communalisation, either land being owned and run communally. And this fit in perfectly with the ideas of the Defenders, who wanted to level the land, literally, which is an old English saying for basically creating a society without classes, without land ownership. So these things fused. And in my opinion, that was the emergence of Celtic communism, or at least Celtic communalism. Whatever Connolly believed it was, that's where it began, in my mind.
Now, if we move on to your main area of expertise, which will be the Irish community in Scotland, in that period, the late 18th century, early 19th century, how much was that new Irish community in Scotland influenced by secret societies, agrarian radicalism? How much did they take over from Ireland into the new communities in Scotland?
I could say from the very, very beginning of the community, much as we have record, the founding of the community as, you know, a community beyond a couple of hundred began after 1798. There was a huge, as anyone who's read anything about Irish history knows, there was a huge campaign of terror initiated by the British government against Irish people after the failure of the rebellion. In particular, in areas in Ulster, there was a process of free market politics, free market economics that destroyed the native weaving and cotton spinning industries within Ireland. And a large amount of the Catholics and Presbyterian radicals in the north were weavers. This pushed, so through a joint process of terror and economic terror, a huge amount of the community of former or present radicals were pushed into Scotland, which and Northern England, which was a natural kind of industrial hub and merging area for work. These weavers found ready work in Glasgow, primarily in the west of Scotland. Some of them found work in building or digging the canals over to Edinburgh, and that was the beginning of the Edinburgh community of Irish, which became quite important later in terms of where Connolly came from. And it would seem, given the evidence of people like Martin Mitchell, that the Defenders went with them, and that cells of Defenders were set up to almost mimic, or not even mimic, they were maybe wholesale moved over and continued their operations there. It became much more of a proto-union at that point. I mean, there's a can't remember the name of the author now, but he proposes such a scenario for ribbon men in Liverpool. And I would suggest that it's probably the same in the west of Scotland, so there's not as much evidence for it. Or rather, it's not, the work hasn't been done on it. But I would say that the founding of the community in Scotland was a radical base or radical foundation. And the evidence for Irish involvement in strikes at the time and in the radical war of 1820 is patchy. They probably were there. Certainly there was a weaver strike in 1812, I think it was, or it was 1814. We don't have the evidence for how many of them were Irish because they didn't take notes in terms of nationality. But I would say, given the proportion of Irish that had emigrated at the time and the large amount of destruction of the weaving industry in Ireland, that a proportion of them were Irish. They just perhaps weren't going around calling themselves Irish. And then later on in the 1820s, they were involved in the beginning of the cotton spinning unions, or rather unions at the time were illegal. After, I think it was 1877 or thereabouts, the British government under Pitt brought in the Combination Acts, which basically made it illegal to combine as workers, i.e. to form a trade union. As E.P. Thompson has shown in The Making of the English Working Class, just very rarely stopped people doing it. They just called themselves something else, like a society or a union society. And there's quite a few union societies in Scotland at the time, and I would suggest that given the fact that there was not the anger to or anti-Irishness which was prevalent later, that they probably quite easily joined these groups. Though again, that would probably be a debated fact.
And just to touch on as well the role of the Irish community in the mining industry.
And in Lanarkshire, yeah.
And especially the radicalism among miners. Mm.
From what my memory of what I've written on it is that, and what has been written by it, by Campbell, I think, is that the Lanarkshire miners were quite a radical group, given the fact that they, I think they had quite comfortable wages. I might be wrong about that. And that the Irish had traditionally been called scabs in this area, and they were blacklegs. And it was believed that they had no political consciousness. They were just there to make a quick buck and then move on. However, from bits of evidence that have been brought forward by Campbell, it seems now that it was a mixed bag. While there was scabs who were Irish, and there were blacklegs who were Irish, there were also a large amount of Irish involved in the unions and in the various strikes that happened. If they were not in the unions, they certainly took part in the strikes. It seems that there was a certain part of the Irish community which was more migratory and would come into the area and then leave quite soon. And by all means, they were probably scabs. But there was also established Irish community which was involved intricately with the industrial movements and were supportive of them. So it wasn't all the same thing. It was that the Irish who lived and worked with the Scots there were more likely to, you know, take part in strikes and maybe even be part of unions and be quite important members of those either industrial actions or the industrial unions. But as I said, there were also scabs and blacklegs who were Irish.
Now, if we moved on slightly and looked at the Chartist movement, who were the Chartists and what was the Irish role in the Chartist movement?
The Chartists were basically a British reform movement led by Irishman Fergus O'Connor and Bronte O'Brien. So at the very tip-top of the movement, the ideological and leadership roles were by Irish radicals. Also, as it happened, to be quite vehement enemies of Daniel O'Connell for reasons which we'll talk about in a minute. The Chartists were a reforming movement, as I said, who desired to bring about economically a reversal of the Industrial Revolution. They wanted to bring back the pre-industrial society that had existed as it had previous to the Industrial Revolution. Fergus O'Connor desired to rehouse people in the countryside and establish kind of a system of cooperative ownership, not communal ownership, cooperative ownership, whereby people would have a tenant, like a farm, there would be tenants on the land and cooperatively would run society. They also had ideas of yearly parliaments. They wanted a universal suffrage whereby universal male suffrage, whereby every man, regardless of, they wanted to have a universal male suffrage for a yearly parliament, whereby every man over 18 or I believe or 21 would have the vote, regardless of if they had property or how much they earned.
There would have been a very limited franchise at that time, wouldn't there?
Yeah, there was. It was basically, I want to say, aristocracy for the most part. After 1832, there was an increase. The 1832 Reform Act, which had been brought on by the reform movement the previous 2 years, allowed certain sections of the middle class and the mercantile class to gain the vote. And it certainly increased, and had in many ways the Chartist movement was the working class rump combined with, you know, a leadership class that were radical middle class people like Fergus O'Connor. In many ways, the reform movement had of the 1830s had appeased the middle class, certain sections of the middle class. Whereas the Chartists represented mostly working class people, which is why it's known as the first kind of working class movement. As I said, they desired to universal manhood suffrage, yearly parliaments, to reverse the negative effects of the Industrial Revolution, and in general kind of promote workers' rights.
And the Irish community in Scotland, how involved were they in this?
It's a very debated subject. Because of the role of O'Connell. Daniel O'Connell and Fergus O'Connor were probably as the biggest enemies you can come across. I mean, they despise one another politically and personally. Fergus Conn had been a supporter of Connell in the 1820s, but they'd had a falling out over political and personal reasons, and O'Connell had basically ensured that Fergus O'Connell had been an MP, and O'Connell ensured that he did not keep his seat, and which promoted Fergus O'Connell to move to Britain and engage in radical politics there. O'Connell had blacklisted Fergus O'Connell and the Chartists for the Irish community. He had no interest in. And he very much desired Irish people to have nothing to do with Fergus O'Connor and anything he's part of. It wasn't so much that they had a problem with the Chartists. They didn't. There was a similar group called the Universal Suffrage League, I think, which emerged around the same time. And they gave their full support to that, including the various points. The Chartists, basically, the reason why they had their name was they had a charter, which wherever they would gain a name, they would try and get a petition to petition the Parliament, and they had some basic universal rights or points which they had established as which the government should establish. And as I said, the points I already raised in regards to their basic ideologies were in those points. O'Connell had no problem with that. He did have, a problem with Fergus O'Connor, and easily supported the Universal Suffrage League, which had the same points as the Chartists. So for the most part, I think it's been proven that Irish people were not en masse involved or members of Chartist movements or involved in them. However, there was some involvement, and certainly they could work together without problem, they would certainly be part of it. There is evidence that suggests that the Chartists, when there was not involvement by the O'Connellites, the leadership class of the O'Connellites, that Irish people were quite predisposed to Chartists. There was just cases of about 500 rowdy Irish people being at Chartist meetings in Glasgow and shouting and hollering or whatever until basically the Chartists engaged in started talking about Ireland, in which case that their tune completely changed overnight, immediately, and they were yelling and supporting them and running up and hugging them. So I mean, I would suggest that it was, for the most part, there was quite a given the amount of illiteracy and the power that the O'Connellites, who were obviously quite in bed with the church at the time, had over the Irish population, that most of them didn't really realize what the Chartists stood for, but and they probably would have supported them if they did.
Now, we might just move on to the famine, and what effect did the famine and the new mass emigration of Irish people into Scotland, what effect did that have on the Irish community's involvement in wider political issues in Scotland, their involvement in radical politics and trade unionism, and also, what was the feeling then towards the Irish community from the native Scottish community following the famine?
It had a huge, enormous effect. The Irish people that moved to Scotland generally came from the same area, which was Ulster. It was about 90% in their entire, in the main area of emigration between 1790 and the early 20th century came from Ulster. And it was about 2/3 were generally Catholic and about 1/3 were Protestant. So in terms of where they're coming from hadn't changed. But the Ireland that they came from had changed enormously from the 1790s to the 1840s and 1850s. Radicalism within there was no longer a defender community. There was the previous agrarian society still existed, and now the ribbon men were dominant in the area at the time. They were much more of a nationalist kind of reactionary movement. They had their social side, and by all means, they wanted to, level the land, as it were, as much as the defenders, but they didn't have the Jacobin streak within them, which is what the defenders had, and the community, and hence what established community in Scotland. Also, there was enormous hatred and desire for revenge for what had happened during the famine, which is which is understandable. They'd seen their families starve to death, if not become diseased, and literally die on the march to a port to get out of Ireland, or in the fields of their home. So the Irish community arriving in Scotland were very, very angry. At the same time, the British community had become quite frightened of the Irish community, not just because of the huge influx of the famine or because of the 1848 escapade, I wouldn't call it a revolution, in Ireland. At the same time, in Britain, in particular in Manchester, there had been an alliance between the rump of the Chartists, the leftovers of the Chartist movement, which had died off for the most part by 1848, and Irish communities aligned with the Irish Confederation in Ireland. It seems they were attempting to mount quite a small revolution, particularly in Manchester and parts of Lancashire. That had been crushed completely, but at the same time, there was newspaper campaign at the time saying that the Irish are dangerous, these people can't trust, and it began the process of painting the Irish as simian terrorists, basically. That was basically the image of them, the monkeys with barrels of gunpowder on their backs. And at the same time, there was the Catholic Church, the hierarchy had been reallowed, i.e. had been kind of sanctified by the government, and there was a huge amount of anti-Catholic attacks against the Irish community within all parts of Britain, but in particular in Scotland, given the huge fundamentalism on the part of the Presbyterian Church. So all these things coalesced to create a kind of like a perfect storm, if you will. And the Irish community was basically withdrew within itself for its own protection, and at the same time, at the behest of the Catholic Church, which provided them with education, poor though it may be, and a primitive form of healthcare. And they withdrew into their, I wouldn't call them ghettos, but I would say it's their slums. In the case of Edinburgh, it was Cowgate. In terms of Glasgow, it was many different areas within Glasgow, but the Gorbals and Calton, and obviously in various parts of the West, like Ayr and Airdrie. And yes, for the most part, for the next 20 years, they remained within their communities and didn't involve themselves in the politics for fear of being attacked. And they were attacked in terms of anti-Catholic riots and burning out of chapels, the burning out of Irish districts, the wholesale driving of Irish communities out of small villages. The next 20 years, it was rife. There was big riots and attacks on Irish communities up until the late 1870s. The Irish did what they had to do to survive, which, you know, was to keep quiet. At the same time, there was the emergence of the Fenian movement in Ireland, which transferred over here. Probably came over with the Ribbon Men. I'd say the Ribbon Men were often joint members of the IRB, and or at the very least had very basic Fenian leanings. And the movement probably came over much like a bit of like a bad cold, the British government must have thought. And yes, and within Scotland, there was a huge anti-Fenian fever between 1865 and 1868. And there's plenty of evidence now that the Irish were in fact involved, probably in quite significantly large numbers. There was quite a lot of midnight drilling. The police were always hearing about reports of drilling up on the moors, drilling in the mountains, of attempted attacks on or planned attacks on factories. It would seem that there was a very large desire in the first and second generation famine immigrants to gain revenge for what had happened, and the Fenians were the force that seemed to be able to do it. They hadn't been crushed yet. Their secret society had prevented them from being crushed. It seemed like something could be done. A distraction could be made in Scotland, and that was the plan. There was Fenians. The IRB planned to create a distraction within, like the Irish community would radicalise and arm within Scotland and Northern England, and that they would create a distraction to the British army so that a rebellion in Ireland could succeed. And this, in many ways, it was more highly organised and successful in this scheme in Scotland and Northern England than it ever was in Ireland. It, as we all know, it fell on its arse completely in Ireland. There is evidence now that the people were gathering together to march on Glasgow and to march on Edinburgh when it was announced that the revolution had failed in Ireland completely. And they just dispersed. Obviously, this did not help the scenario, the situation the Irish were in. There was further repression, further fear of the community. So at least, so another that added to the fuels of distrust and anger for another 10 years. So, but by the end of the 1870s and the emergence of the Home Rule movement, the Irish community, if not being accepted, had at least stopped being attacked by the Scottish native Scots.
We're just going to take a very quick break and we'll be back with Alex O'Faley after the break. Now, Alex, before the break, you were talking about the IRB and the Fenians, and you were starting to move on to the whole issue of Home Rule and the Latin League. What effect did that have on the Irish community in Scotland?
It had a probably as big as effect as the famine immigration, in the sense of, in the ideological sense. It was a huge change from a physical force, much like in Ireland, it's the change from physical force to constitutional agitation. The Irish community in Glasgow in particular were highly involved in land league politics. Michael Davitt has a well-established history of being involved in Scottish politics, and he seemed to have been involved in creating quite a radicalized land league kind of home rule movement in Glasgow, which was involved in radicalizing the Scots in Skye and other parts of the Highlands, which at just before the beginning of the Crofters' War, which was a similar event to the Land League, but much more small and smaller scale. It would seem that the this group, while not leading the movement in any sense, they did not do that. They agitated, they stirred the pot in Skye. At the same time, there's evidence of fishermen from Skye. When they were coming into port in parts of Cork, and who say they were given land league propaganda. I mean, there's a process of osmosis between radicalism evident within rural Ireland in the 1870s and rural parts of Scotland at the same time. It wasn't just these radicals within Glasgow. There was cross contamination, if you will. And that after the First Land Act, there was a bill brought in for Scotland, I think it was 1885, which was based off the Land Act bill. But it was word for word transferred over. It was a general belief that this would be a good solution. If it's a good solution for Ireland, it's a good solution for Scotland. This is a whole other school talking about a belief in native radicalism within the Scottish clans. I'm not going to go into that because that's a different field altogether. Though there is some evidence to suggest that there are similar ideas of a pre-existing society which is egalitarian, which influenced Scottish society. At the same time, the same group in Glasgow was involved in the Home Rule movement, more in the 1880s, but also parts of the 1870s. And they became quite a libertarian force within the movement. At the time, Parnell is known as the uncrowned king of Ireland, or basically the uncrowned king of Ireland, but he was not, he was quite a, and in the sense of a king, he was quite authoritarian within his own movement. He demanded quite a large amount of loyalty and deference. The Glaswegian Home Rule movement did not follow that line at all. They believed in kind of having a federated system of councils and groups, and they believed in kind of having decentralized power. They didn't like the idea that Parnell had all this power, and he found them a major pain in the ass at the time. And several times they tried to bring in bills to remove power from him and then the kind of central clique which surrounded him. Without success, they met with very little success. Were almost always the only voice of dissension within these meetings. But they kind of establishes a kind of a trend of anti-authoritarian radicalism, which goes back, as we said, all the way back to 1790s. It's in many ways quite similar to the ideas of E.P. Thompson, of a belief of not a group of people, not an organization, but a central idea which influences people, something that is beneath the surface, it doesn't die out because the people who were part of the United Irishmen or the Defenders or even the Ribbon Men and the IRB, just because they die or leave, it doesn't leave, it's still there beneath the surface. This carries on, as I said, in the Land League and the Home Rule movement, and progressed finally and fulfilled in many ways its raison d'etre in the labor movement, which is the final area of the book, which describes kind of the Irish community's integration within British society within the context of a, kind of a socialistic labour movement.
When I was reading through some of your work there, you draw the comparison between Liverpool, which also has a huge Irish community. The Irish political movements in Liverpool are able to get a Home Rule MP elected. They have their own branches of the Irish Parliamentary Party. And in Glasgow and other parts of Scotland, they don't have the same power to get their own MP elected. But what did that Home Rule and Irish National League, how did they throw their support behind other political candidates?
Well, generally, the Irish National League desired, and Parnell desired, the Irish community in Britain to vote for the Liberal Party. The goal was, we get the Libs and then elected, we'll do a deal with them and they'll give us Home Rule. And that was generally the rule, and you obey it. In Glasgow, there was a lot of dissension about that, specifically from a man called John Ferguson, and probably John Wheatley as well. They believed that the Irish community should be able to vote for who they like, and that was often, they often support the idea of voting for socialist candidates and Labour candidates. At the time, there was no Labour Party, but there was a proto-Labour grouping of trade unionists who were quite politicised, like I think Keir Hardie, I could be right, before he, I think he was the first Scottish Labour parliamentary member, but before that he was quite a staunch trade unionist trying to bring about a new Labour Party. So there was quite a desire for them to vote, and on the municipal level, there's quite a lot of evidence to suggest where the national question was not an issue, Irish people were voting for Labour and trade union candidates when they were put forward. There was still a degree of hesitancy by the Parnell and his grouping, but there wasn't as much of an issue with it, and the evidence would suggest that when the option of a Labour candidate was on the ballot, and there was not an issue of, there wasn't the Irish national issue wasn't on at stake, they would vote for Labour candidates. This leads into the 1890s, when the National Union of Dock Labourers emerged. Now, the Irish are notorious from at least probably the 1860s to 1870s for being involved in dockers movement. In Edinburgh, it was about 20%, in Leith, and in Glasgow, it was about 60% of dockers were Irish. And that's only that's first generation, let alone probably more, including second generation. And by the 1890s, they were in the National Union of Dock Labourers, which is, anyone who studied Irish history knows, is where Jim Larkin was involved in. It was a very radical union. And in fact, Larkin actually was in Glasgow for a brief time before he came to Belfast and was involved in the union. But in the 1890s, particularly at the beginning of it, 1890s, the movement was dominated by Irish members. And there was quite a radical culture of industrial strikes and wildcat strikes the time, which kind of fits into the general tradition of when the Irish can find their way to dominate a union, as they did in the 1820s and 1830s with the cotton spinners union. They become quite a radical force, or at least they see the union seems to become quite radicalized. I would say that this fits into the idea of this tradition of radicalism as well. This would continue for a while. Obviously, there was quite a, as we all know, by the late 1890s and the early 1900s, the leadership of the union became quite conservative. They had a big problem with Jim Larkin promoting these ideas of he's a sympathetic strike, and which was in fact practiced by in kind of a primitive form in Glasgow by the Irish dockers. In many ways, the Irish were now being involved in this new union movement, which had merged since the 1880s. However, they, for the most part, were not involved in socialist parties. There was a belief propagated by the Vatican that socialism was anathema to Catholicism. And obviously, people were very loyal Catholics at this time. A man came about who tried to change this, and I think one can say he did, and that he changed people's opinions to such an extent. By 1916 to 1920, Irish people were voting en masse for the Labour Party, and they were generally kind of converted to an idea of socialism. His name was John Wheatley, and the group he had was called the Catholic Socialist Society. From the mid-1900s to about 1912, he had grown up in the mining communities in the west of Scotland as a young Irish immigrant, and moved to Glasgow with his brother and had a small business before he got involved in the Home Rule movement. But he was always influenced by his past as a kind of a poor miner, and he started to get involved, much like John Ferguson did, with the union movements and the socialistic movements. He was converted to a kind of a British socialism rather than a European Marxism. And his desire was always to better the Irish population's position. And he didn't see that as possible as long as the Irish refused to be involved in socialistic movements and kind of the dominant radical ideology at the time. So he took it upon himself to form a group called the Catholic Socialist Society, which had a column in the main Irish newspaper at the time, the Observer. There was a kind of a running battle debate between him and Catholic clergy and other Catholics within the community, as well as he was also supported by other Catholics who were dissenting voices. And there had always been a dissenting voice within the Catholic community, the Irish Catholic community. It's been small, but it's been there. There's evidence of it going back to even to the 1850s and 1860s, when the Catholic Church was dominant. It was still a voice there, and there's evidence of it. And at the same time, one has to point out the Catholic Church wasn't wholly controlling. There was evidence of individual Catholic priests being quite radical. There's evidence of them basically not allowing certain Irish Catholic priests into Scotland for fear that they would radicalize the population. There's evidence of Scottish bishops having to severely berate and remove Irish Catholic priests for what they were saying at the pulpit, which was quite radical. Up until 1901, there's evidence of Catholic priests in I think it's East Lothian or Mid Lothian forming groups to protest the Boer War. There's a long tradition of that as well, but nonetheless, it was while they could be anti-imperial and radical in some ways, they were very against the Catholic hierarchy was against the idea of socialism, and they believed it wanted to remove religion, specifically the Catholic Church. Wheatley sought to remove this idea, and I think successfully over a period of about 10 years, through having honest, open debate, through refusing, kind of turning the other cheek when there was a case of a large group of Irish Catholics who had been poked to such fury by their priest, marched with an effigy of Wheatley to his house, burning, trying to kill him. And he stood in front of his door and he took the insults and he didn't back down. And then in the end, they walked away. I think in many ways, if you ever believe in an idea of Catholicism, of religion, he showed more of that spirit than the Catholic clergy ever did. And that worked. I think his genuine desire to help people's lives and change people's lives, and when he got into the first Labour government of the 1822 to 1824, he brought in housing bills and various acts which helped actual people in poor areas of Scotland and Northern England. And I think his example and the debates he had with the Catholic clergy and the genuine more accepting culture in Scotland at the time, Irish people, I mean, by at this point they were could have been in their sixth to seventh generation and of immigrants. At that point, you're not an immigrant, you're far from an immigrant, but that was what they were perceived as. But I think by then it was changing. I think people were accepting the Irish Catholics, and they were becoming more Scottish Irish, or just Scots, rather than just Irish within Scotland. So it was a process, a long drawn out process of, you know, as we've recounted, about 100 years of the Irish community trying to fit in. I think combined with this conversion to social democracy, at the very least, if not socialism in certain cases, and by the 1820s, the Irish community were in general across the board in all parts of Britain voting primarily for the Labour Party, it would suggest that not only they'd fit in, but they were able to use their kind of their cultural radicalism, find a niche for it within British politics, which suited them very well and allowed them to fit in completely.
Now, if we could move on to probably the most famous person to come out of this Irish radicalism in Scotland, James Connolly. How does his views about the new unionism, the new trade unionism, and also socialist politics, how did that affect the Irish community?
The thing that's very interesting about Connolly is that his family came from Monaghan, which was right at this one of the main counties which had been experienced that radicalism, which I talked about in the 1790s. I don't know if I can prove it, but my opinion is his family, not only did they come from that area, which I have described as quite radicalized, probably still was by the, I think he was born in 1868, so 1860 was still pretty radicalized. And he moved into Cowgate, which was a very poor, probably one of the poorest Irish slums in existence, and very internal. It was generally about 60% of the people living in the Cowgate were Irish, maybe more. I'd say that he was completely surrounded by Irishness, and I would say, given what I've talked about now, probably there was that strain of radicalism existed. I think what he believed Celtic communism was is an exaggerated form of what the radicalism that did exist. The radicalism that we've talked about, which is beneath the surface, which had general ideas of egalitarianism and land ownership, in particular the idea of communal land ownership or state ownership of land, which had emerged throughout the 19th century by theorists like Bronte or O'Brien and kind of
Fintan Lawler.
Yeah. And even Fergus O'Connor and had ideas on that. And then later on in, obviously, Michael Davitt, various other kind of social thinkers at the time. There was a general pattern of belief of kind of either state ownership or communal ownership, which is there. I believe he believed he saw this as an inherent communalistic communistic trait. And as it can be seen in other communities, like in Peru, there's an idea of Inca communism, and in Tanzania, there was an idea of village communism. It's an old trait, it's an old idea of giving modern political ideologies a longer route or a longer history than they have. I think he came at it from the right direction. He certainly, I think he was obviously biased at the time. I probably would be too if I was there at the time. What did that give the Irish community in Scotland? Not very much. He grew up in Edinburgh, which is a very conservative town even to today, and the Irish generally didn't seem to listen to him. There was not that many of them there, and they just wanted to get by. They were a tiny percentage of the population dominated by land and wealth surrounding them. They just wanted to get by. At the moment, or in the last 50, 60 years, he's had more of an influence on the Scottish-Irish community and in terms of kind of a cultural sense of rebellion, which is more from 1916. His labour ideas certainly added to the fold at the time of general socialism in Scotland, but he didn't find his real niche until he moved to Ireland, or rather re-moved to Ireland in 1910, when he came back from America, which is when he wrote Labour History of Ireland, which is the key text for his concept of Celtic communism. So I think if he affected the Irish community in Scotland or Scotland at all, it was more after he left. And while he was there, I don't think so. I think, if anything, you can say that his concept of Celtic communism, if we're just going to focus on that, is something that came from, it was a Scottish, oddly, a Scottish import to Ireland. I think his idea of what it was something that had formed, had fermented and kind of bubbled away with the diaspora community in Scotland and probably other areas as well. But I think primarily it was Scotland and Northern England that this kind of trend, which had emerged in the 1790s in Ulster, had been moved over to Scotland and Northern England, had met the reform movement, had met the primitive unionists, had met the Chartists, had been influenced by the Fenians, had been involved with the Liberals when they were in alliance with the Home Rule movement, had been influenced by the new unionism, the socialism of the coming over from the continent. In my eyes, he was influenced by that, not anything that existed in Ireland at the time. Even a casual observance of Irish history will say by 1910, Irish society was dominated by a Catholic landed class, which had emerged, had been emerging for a long time, but had been given power by the Land Act. It was not a radical community. There was radicalism, as there always is within societies, but it was not the community he wanted it to be. And I think he would even tell you that. The reason why he couldn't stay in Scotland was because the community was too small. He believed that the small representatives that existed in Scotland, there would be a whole country full of them in Ireland. I think he believed that was true, but when he left Scotland, but he quickly learned it wasn't. And in fact, probably the representatives he left were closer to his ideas than he was ever going to get in Ireland.
Alex O'Faley, thank you very, very much. That's a very interesting discussion there. That was the History Show on Near FM. My name is Carl Brennan, and thank you very much for listening.
Hello and welcome to the History Show on Near 90 FM. My name is John Dorney, and if you would like to listen to this or previous episodes of the programme, please go to nearpodcast.org/pcast/. This week we're very pleased to be joined by Dr. Padraig Lenihan. Padraig is a historian of early modern Ireland. He's written Confederate Catholics at War, The Battle of the Boyne, and Consolidating Conquest. Padraig, you're very welcome to the show.
Thanks, John.
Padraig, we're going to be talking today about the writing of history in early modern Ireland. But before we talk about the history, or the writing of history. Briefly, can you tell us why these two centuries, the 16th and the 17th century, are so contentious in Irish history?
The early modern period, compared to the medieval or the modern, is in itself, anyway, it's untidy. It's got these jarring kind of bits of the old coexisting with the new. Now, in the case of Ireland, it's a period of conquest, forcible incorporation of Ireland within a three-kingdom polity, and ultimately, at the end of it, within a unitary kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland. That is something that doesn't happen organically. It is an externally imposed forceful process, conquest. Therefore, questions of violence, expropriation, religious change, top-down cultural change, all of these issues loom large. And the legacy of that period is of two communities on the island, which were historically, for much of that period, at odds with one another, with the exception of what turned out to be something of a false dawn in 1798.
Mm-hmm. Now, George Orwell very famously said that whoever controls the present controls the past. So what attempts did the English conquerors of 16th century Ireland make to shape a history of what they were doing and where they were coming from?
Well, I suppose the best known is Edward Spencer's view of the present state of Ireland, which was circulating in manuscript from the late 1590s. It wasn't actually published until 1633. Spencer is well known because he was a poet, the author of The Fairy Queen, I suspect more often written about than actually read. But Spencer's view has two people in dialogue, and they evaluate the Irish problem. And for him, the problem is based on a false premise. The solution of gradual reform, peaceful reform, using normal peacetime legal process to bring the Irish to a more advanced state of civility. It's assumed that's what should go on. That's wrong. You need to start with violence. Evils, he says, Irenaeus, one of the speakers, says, must first be cut away with a strong hand. In other words, you have to destroy before you can build. So that sets up his view, as it were, of the Irish. So that well-known quote where he's talking about the rats coming out of woods during the famine that was associated with the Desmond Uprising in the 1580s, that's often assumed to be a reaction of horror. It's not. He's saying this is what needs to happen. We must break before we can build. Fiennes Morrison would be another ideologue of conquest. He was associated with, he was the secretary of Mountjoy, the man who finished the conquest of Ireland in 1603. And Morrison's view of the Irish, he doesn't articulate a programmatic response, but his view of the Gaelic Irish is invariably hostile in his depiction of their clothes, their cleanliness, their sexual habits, their diet, their agriculture, their primitive, barbarous, dirty, all of the above. John Davies, his discovery of the true causes, 1612, he was exercised, Davies was, by the problem, why did the earlier Anglo-Norman conquest fail? What happened to those English settlers? And what happened to them was, as Morrison knows this week, they degenerated. They moved down a notch in the scale of being, as it were, from their original genus or people to the other. So they were absorbed by the Irish. How do we stop that happening again? That exercises Davies. And again, his prescription is that he uses the agricultural metaphor. As the husbandman tills the soil, you've got to break the soil first. Break the land first, then you can sow the seed, but you have to break the land first. So they're all advocating a violent, and I use the word violent advisedly, shock to native society. A destruction of it, in effect, before you can build something new on its ruins. So that's the, I'm not oversimplifying, I mean, that is the general gist ideological, English ideological programs for towards the end of the century. Earlier ideas of gradualist reform have been cast aside.
Mm-hmm. So when English writers are writing about the conquest of Ireland, they're saying that it's improving Ireland, but that it can only be improved by smashing it first, essentially.
You can. Well, they're not about Ireland so much as the Gaelic Irish. They want to build something new in Ireland, and that something new will be the transplantation of English civility. That may happen by transforming the natives, making them civil. Civil is assumed to be English. It's assumed to be better. That's axiomatic. The only dispute is whether you do so gradually or quickly by violent expropriation and conquest. Or else do you plant people, and how many, to accelerate that process. So you're trying two different tacks. You're trying to replace the existing natives, and you're trying to acculturate them or civilize them, literally.
Mm-hmm. Now, this was a process which culminated in what we call now the Nine Years' War and the Battle of Kinsale, and all that followed, the establishment of the English Kingdom of Ireland. When Irish people were looking back at this process in the 17th century, and they were trying to explain it when they were writing histories, people like Geoffrey Keating, Donal O'Sullivan Bear, how did they interpret what had happened in Ireland, or how did they present what had happened in Ireland?
The most common motif in the 17th century, and this is true for the wars of the mid-century as well as for the Nine Years' War, is the providentialist motif. It's not a particularly Irish response. It's the old question, the age-old question, why do bad things happen to good people? Why did this happen to us? Why was it? And the only explanation you can come at is that it is in some way Judas Jesus, the revenge of God. It's God's judgment on us. We have done something wrong. And it's finding what that was, agreeing on what it was, whether it's unity, division, other forms of sinfulness, and remedying it, is the prescription. So that's a general, if there was one common theme that runs through this 17th century. But you have a plethora of writing from the Irish Catholic side. Philip O'Sullivan Bear's Catholic History of Ireland, written in Lisbon 1621. You have Keating's Forus Fassa, which is an enormously influential Forus Fassa Arrearn, or Foundation of Knowledge of Ireland, which is a sort of a mytho history of Ireland. So it's most important because in his preface he is at pains to disagree with the Gerald of Wales, the 12th century historian of the Anglo-Norman conquest, where he had said that where he had castigated the native Irish, and he's taking issue with that. For somebody like Keating, in his introduction to the Forus Fassa, the likes of Gerald of Wales, Davies, Morris and Spencer, they're dung beetles. They're interested in, they walk along the ground, they ignore the flowers, they ignore the achievements of Gaelic society, but they concentrate on the less wholesome aspects of native society, and they exaggerate those and they concentrate on those completely. There's an awful lot of writing from the Irish Catholic side. In the 1640s you have writings like the Commentarius Rinuccinianus or Cambrensis Versus, the Rinuccini Commentaries or the Opposition, the Versus, the critique of Cambrensis, respectively from O'Farrell and O'Connell on the one hand and John Lynch on the other. These writings are fighting about what went wrong in the 1640s, whose fault it was. Should we have supported Charles I more wholeheartedly, or should we have insisted on backing the Pope and his delegate, or his ambassador, papal ambassador.
Nuncio.
I'm getting a senior moment there. But yes. Papal nuncio, and backing him more wholeheartedly. So you have these debates. When you're looking at the wars of the Williamite Wars, you look at Charles O'Kelly's Macaria Exigidium on the one hand, which takes, I suppose, an anti-Richard Talbot pro-Gaelic view of the thing, and you have the history attributed to Nicholas Plunkett. All of these emerged. Very few of those are in print. They're either in Latin, and they're not translated until the 19th century, if even yet. I mean, the Commentarius has not yet been translated, so there's still work to be done there. You have Lugaid O'Clery's Bath Éireann O'Donnell, or Life of Red Hugh O'Donnell, which would be, I suppose, the most important of the Irish language ones, along with Forrest Fassa. You have most of that work is in Latin. Relatively little of it is in English, and relatively little of it is published. Mm-hmm. Much of it remains in manuscript, like the aphorismical discovery of treasonable faction, Richard Melling's history, the Light to the Blind. They only are rediscovered, as it were, and edited in the 19th century. So that if you're looking at a debate between the two communities in Ireland, the English in Ireland have their Temple's History of the Rebellion, William King's Death of the Protestants. They have a series of well-articulated texts in print that go into many editions. So they, as it were, set the terms of the debate, and the Irish, insofar as they're contesting this, they're contesting it with publications from Louvain, like Hugh Riley's Ireland's Case Stated, or French's The Settlement and Sale of Ireland, but those are relatively few in number. Most of the Irish case, to a great extent, goes by default.
Mm-hmm. But just before we leave the 17th century, we mentioned Catholicism and the Pope there. So from this period, didn't Irish historians create probably the idea that the Catholic people and the Irish people were the same thing?
Well, the Irish identity is, many early moderns would say, is something that is created. Created by clergymen, by clerics, by the deliberate, integration of the Old English, those are descendants of the 12th century settlers, and the Gaelic Irish, and by focusing on what they had in common, their shared religious identity, their shared historical experience, and their shared identity to our opposition to English government policies in Ireland. So therefore, yes, religion becomes a central building block of Irish identity from the 17th century, and remains so to a greater or lesser extent. And as I say, it sort of breaks down perhaps in the 1790s. The sectarian lines harden again in the 18-teens and 20s, there onwards. So yes, this is a long-term process.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of our memory and our understanding of the 16th and 17th century in Ireland, what's one thing that's in the way is the 19th century, and that was a time when a lot of the texts you've talked about were actually rediscovered. Can you say something about that?
Yes, many of the texts from the 17th century were translated. I mean, some of them remain yet to be translated. I mean, I'm working myself with a classicist on a very long poem in Latin, written by a Jacobite official, which has never been published, which is never in Latin or English or translation. It's out there. So there's work still to be done. But the Commentarius was published in, that's a multi-volume history of the 1640s, very detailed, very interesting information. That was published in Latin in the 1930s by the Irish Manuscripts Commission, but has yet to be translated. But a lot of the more accessible manuscript sources were gathered by people like Gilbert, J.T. Gilbert, he's a marvellous antiquarian, and published in the 19th century. So you have the 19th century, the interest with this in the 17th century is not as perhaps intense as it was in the 18th century, where the debate over the 1641 rising or the massacre is at its most intense. You have, someone like Thomas Davis writes a lot about the early modern period, about the so-called Patriot Parliament, the Jacobite Parliament. A lot of his songs, poems, and historical pieces concern Owen Roe O'Neill, the Wild Geese, and so on. But for Mitchell, on the other hand, the other great exponent of 19th century nationalism, he starts his history from the Treaty of Limerick. You also have, from the Irish Catholic Bible, you have a clerical tincture to this as well. Some of the best of these historians are, like Murphy, Dennis Murphy, his Cromwell in Ireland, it's a fine history. Patrick Moran's persecution of Irish Catholics and penal laws. These are more, he's more polemical or more strident. You have Prendergast, he was a barrister, J.P. Prendergast, his landmark Cromwellian settlement in Ireland, 1893. Thomas Fitzpatrick's Bloody Bridge, a refutation of the, probably the best of the refutations of the massacre myth of 1640, 1641 rather. And on the other side, you have Mary Hickson's Ireland in the 17th century, which, notwithstanding the title, is actually about, it reproduces many of the, a lot of depositions, to some extent culls them to get the, but doesn't, if you like, falsify, but culls them to get the to make the case, I suppose, of an irredeemable collective guilt on the part of the Irish for this massacre. So a lot of stuff, a lot of writing coming out in the 19th century, but not as intense an engagement, I think, as in the 18th century.
Mm-hmm. That brings us to the 20th century. Now, obviously, in the 20th century, we have another great break in Irish history, which might in some ways be comparable with the 17th century, and that is that British rule ends in most of Ireland, and a whole new understanding of history comes about. So how did this affect people's understanding of the 16th and 17th centuries?
You're asking me about revisionism.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in the context of the Northern Troubles, there was, I suppose, an understandable public-minded idea of coming to trying to focus on a useful history, a history that doesn't inflame people, that doesn't focus over much on the bad stuff, the atrocities, the perpetrated by one community and the other, and that's understandable. However, the problem with that, I suppose, is when if you start distorting, and you can distort, as long as you, that's fine, as long as you don't distort the truth, as long as you don't tell lies. But when you elide or evade what happened, then you're in danger of not telling the truth, and that's problematic. Or you're in danger at the very least of coming up with a very bland history. So the famous critique of this process is Brendan Bradshaw's Nationalism and Historical Scholarship. Now, I wouldn't go along with everything he says, but he makes some very powerful points. For him, the process, the term, of course, revisionist, is something that every historian worth his or her salt would say, I am a revisionist. You wouldn't pick up a pen or hit the keyboard to write in the first place if you didn't have something to revise, something to say that was different from what had been said before. But in the Irish context, revisionism has a different meaning. For its proponents, it's revising a mytho history of Irish nationalism, where it's taking apart the idea that you have this immemorial Irish nation in perpetual struggle with its English oppressors over a period of centuries. The struggle essentially remains the same, and you're trying to deconstruct that, and you're trying to say, look, hang on, maybe this idea of a collective nationhood or collective identity was relatively late, they would say, maybe as late as the 19th century. They would tend to focus on divisions within, if you like, the Irish Catholic or nationalist community, by way of illustrating this lack of cohesiveness over time. And they would be more comfortable with, I suppose, the exceptional individuals and the survivors and the people who made some sort of terms with rather than those who were advocating a collective resistance. For Bradshaw, this wasn't, on its own terms, value-free history, because it focuses a very sceptical and destructive, what he called an invincible scepticism against Irish nationalism and its story. It argues that there is no grand narrative, there is no big story. Mm-hmm. Thus, if you look at the proclamation of 1916, what is it, six times in the past 200 years Irishmen have struck out. That kind of argument for an Irish nationalist grand narrative for revisionists is unsustainable. And where do you end up eventually? You end up with two things. A, you can end up with a history, and this is a point made by Dave Edwards particularly, which elides the catastrophic dimension of Irish history. This is, Bradshaw makes the point that deliberately or unconsciously, catastrophe is elided. The story of the victims, the dispossessed, that is ignored. And Bradshaw gives the example of Moody's classic study of the Londonderry plantation, 1935. It's an administrative study of governmental or administrative process which doesn't engage with what do the people who are at the receiving end of this think about this. It's written from within the perspective of the people carrying out the plantation. So that's the burden, as it were, of Bradshaw's critique, which all these years on, I mean, holds true. The question isn't as urgent, perhaps, now that the troubles are over, but we've moved into the question of history, and reading history will always be a live one. I mean, even today now, if you look at the way in which history can be distorted, I would give as an example, and I'm moving a little bit from my brief, John, as a nearly modernist, out of my comfort zone now, and I was surprised by the way in which the Minister for Defence, Alan Shatter, Minister for Defence and Justice, handled the question of pardoning deserters from the Irish Army during the Second World War or the emergency or what you will, because his argument for doing that was not just that these, not on a humanitarian basis, which I think a lot of people, personally I wouldn't, but a lot of people would say, yes, a long time ago, they're all men, forgive and forget, and so on. No, the point Alan, Minister Shatter was making is that these men made, they preferred the better moral choice. The vast majority of people who served their country, who maintained their oath, who defended their country during the Second World War against the threat of invasion from either side, they made the less moral choice, the poor choice. He said that. And therefore, what are you doing there? You have the extraordinary situation where a minister is subjecting the past of his own state, of his own department, of his own army, to a very destructive criticism. He's saying that, which is presentist, which is taking a present-centred view. In other words, it's assuming, A, that the Allied powers fought against the Holocaust. They didn't. Every single power that was involved in the Second World War, barring England and France, and Germany, of course, were involved because they were attacked. And because they were attacked, nobody willingly got involved in that war. They did not set out on a crusade against Nazism. Most countries that tried to keep neutral. Some smaller countries managed it, others did not. But to actually criticise the people who kept their oaths, who obeyed, who defended their country, in the light of a present-centred history which doesn't take any account of the realities of that time. It doesn't take account of the fact that the people who might have deserted might have been doing so for ideological motives, that they might the following year have been back with an invasion fleet or columns, which could have happened had there been a British invasion. There are all of these aspects to it. This is where history, the battle for history, is important. I'm digressing a little bit. Can you see the point I'm making at all?
Mm-hmm.
Or you can end up with something very... You can end up with something in the effort to make something that is mutually acceptable to both communities or all communities. You can end up with something that is terribly, terribly land, you can have the National Day of Commemoration, for example, celebrates, as far as I can see, all Irishmen who died anywhere, anytime, for any cause whatsoever. It is a staggeringly vacuous and unengaging history. It presupposes that the very act of fighting and dying in a war, or serving in a war, or serving in an army, somehow elevates the person to be worthy of commemoration, not what they fight for. Thus, we're equally invited to celebrate the Connacht Ranger who put down the sepoys in the Indian Mutiny, or the Irish nationalists who fought on the side of the Boers in the Boer War, or whatever. It's all. Everything is there. It's all there. And at the end of the day, when it's all so all encompassing, all inclusive, it's disengaging. It just doesn't. It's bland. It's not part of any story. So the end result of this revisionist project is that you end up with, instead of a story, a grand narrative or a story which makes sense, which may you need to interrogate to make sure it's not distorting, excluding, whatever, you end up with history as a random assemblage of stuff that happened.
Mm-hmm. Just to wrap up then, I mean, the rejoinder of that is that the revisionists, I guess, if you want to use that word, rejoinder, is that the criticism of the revisionist project is based on the idea that no criticism of Irish nationalism is allowed at all.
No, you have to. I mean, you allow that. For example, you could take the view that. And I often wonder, can you actually speak of an Irish history of Ireland before the 16th or 17th century? You could take the view as a proper subject of study. I mean, was there a unit replaced? You know, legal scholars, linguistic scholars, and others would dispute that. You can take the view that nationalism, as we understand it, an effective mobilising collective identity, might be quite much later. Was it a 19th, 18th, 17th century phenomenon, 16th century? You can differ about these are huge issues that you can differ within. You can accept that an awful lot of, you know, the heroes have feet of clay, that the not everything should be seen in terms of dichotomy, British-Irish or English-Irish, that there are episodes of coexistence, consensus, as well as outbreaks of conflict. It's just that you don't ignore the role of conflict as well. That's what you're saying. So I think what you're trying to do is be more balanced. So the greatest criticism, the most effective criticism the revisionists would have had of Bradshaw was his phrase, use of his phrase, and I may have got it slightly wrong now, but of an empathic, differing, engaging with the past with a degree of empathy or feeling for the past and engagement with it and an emotional identification with it. And they would say, no, you don't. You're a scientist, you're trying to be value-free, you're studying this as a social phenomenon, and that's an area that, you know, the view of the historian's role is he or she scientist or is history and art. That's over to you.
Okay, Pádraig Lenihan, thank you very much.
Okay.